Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to These Football Times World Cup edition. Today, we reach the end of our journey, the World Cup final, the event where heroes are made, villains are cast. We're bringing you six games today from the past, six World Cup finals, some of them brilliant, some of them average, some of them downright terrible. But we make no apologies for that as we take this journey back in time to delve into some of the great, the good and the ugly of World Cup's past. I'm Chris Lepkowski. Today I'm joined by Dave Bowler and Stephen Scragg. Stephen, hello. Hi, how are you?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad. Looking forward to this. Strange time of year to be doing a World Cup final themed podcast at a time when, I don't know, what are we? A week and a half, just under 2 weeks away from Christmas and still got many presents to buy.
By my reckoning, we have 12 days of shopping left. Dave, have you finished all of your shopping so far?
Question is, what have I started doing any of it?
Well, that's the spirit. That's what I wanted to hear. Well, anyway, enough of that jovial, festive nonsense. Let's get into the football. We're going to introduce two games each. And Dave, I'm going to ask you to go first with your opening pick. Now, you've picked games either side of the spectrum in terms of chronology. Tell us about the first game you're going for tonight.
Well, the first one is going all the way back to 1966, which is, of course, is the last time England won the World Cup in both senses of that word.
Is it too soon to mention this in the light of the quarter-final defeat? I think not.
No. Let's have a wait. I don't know. the most recent time that England won the World Cup, and quite possibly the way things are going, the last time England ever won the World Cup. That final, I think, is a really interesting view on the way people look at history, because, of course, it all gets reduced to, you know, two or three moments of caricature. It's did the ball go across the line? It's there's some people on the pitch. You know, it's you've won it once, now go and win it again. And that basically is all that whole thing gets reduced down to. But I think there's a lot more going on in 66, and of course it all revolves around Alf Ramsey, who took over in 63, really took the helm of England in 63 as the first sort of manager who'd got some kind of power over his team. Walter Winterbottom had always been at the mercy of the selection committee up until then, and when Alf Ramsey took over, he was going to be in charge of picking his squad, picking his team and all of that. Right from the outset in 63, he said England were going to win the World Cup in 1966, which is a very un-Alf Ramsey kind of thing to say. I mean, he was a very cautious kind of figure, very studied in the kind of public pronouncements that he made when he was at Ipswich as manager there, and generally as an England boss as well. But he was determined that England were going to win it. And I think, you know, you've got to look at Ramsey's character. I think one of the big elements of, I mean, he was a major, major patriot. I mean, he grew up in the 20s and 30s, went to school when the map of the world was pink, or, you know, the empire, all that kind of stuff. And in footballing terms, Alf Ramsey had been part of the two great humiliations that had befallen England. He was in the team that lost to America in 1950. And then his final international for England was the 6-3 against Hungary at Wembley. And I think, you know, there was something burning deep inside within Alf Ramsey that, you know, we need to put this right, we need to address this. And I think that was a big burning motivation for him all the way through his time as England manager, particularly those first few years. Because, you know, when better chance are you going to have than a home tournament to win the World Cup? Obviously, that England started the tournament pretty slowly, but gradually gained momentum. And the momentum came largely from Jimmy Greaves getting injured. And Jimmy Greaves, I mean, every footballer I've ever spoken to who remembers that era speaks of Jimmy Greaves in, you know, reverent hushed tones as the greatest goal scorer there's ever been and all of that. And you would never have expected an England team to play without Jimmy Greaves or to play successfully without Jimmy Greaves. As it turned out, he got injured and Jeff Hurst came in the quarter-final against Argentina. And that was an England transformed from there. Not just because of Jeff Hurst coming in, but also, Ramsey had dallied with having a winger in the group games. Got to the quarterfinal and he stopped messing about with that sort of nonsense, and just went for the team that he wanted, which was, I suppose, in modern terms, we'd call a 4-1-3-2. With Nobby Stiles as the defensive midfielder. And England just looked a better team for it. Obviously, there's huge amounts of pressure in a home World Cup final, more so than any World Cup final. And they didn't start particularly well. Ray Wilson, who was a genuinely world-class player, as we'll come on to in a bit, he completely misjudged a header. And Helmut Haller got on the end of it and put West Germany in the lead, which England retaliated fairly quickly. Jeff Hurst ghosted into the box and a quickly taken free kick from Bobby Moore, made at Upton Park, as West Ham fans will always tell us, that goal. And England were back in it. And second half, Martin Peters gets on the end of a Jeff Hurst shot, makes it 2-1. And at that point, you're gradually running the clock down. And if it ends at 2-1, it's a really dull, prosaic World Cup final. Nobody ever talks about it ever again, except in this country. And David Baddiel and Frank Skinner make records about it every now and again. But otherwise, the world forgets that World Cup final completely. But West Germany, as West Germany tended to do, equalised in the last minute, took it to extra time. And that was what made it the World Cup final that people still remember. There would have been no Jeff Hurst hat-trick. There would have been no Russian linesman, or Azerbaijani linesman, as we must call him now. There would have been no VAR in 1966 controversy, all that sort of stuff, and that Kenneth Wolstenholme would have been a footnote to football, as opposed to the central voice of English victory. So as everybody knows, Alf Ramsey wouldn't let the England players sit down at the end of the 90 minutes. Got them in the feet. Look at the Germans; they're all exhausted. We'll run them to death in the last half. And that's to a large extent what England did. They ran the West Germans ragged. Jeff Hurst scores that goal that does or doesn't cross the line. Roger Hunt, sorry, Stephen, but what on earth was Sir Roger doing watching that rather than heading it back in? I don't know. And then obviously the final goal that some people on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is now. I mean, my God, what would this country have done without that phrase for the last 50-odd years? That we've used at every possible opportunity. The big thing, I think, is that England team is underrated. I think it was a great England team. I think it's probably the greatest England team, certainly in the post-television era. I mean, whether you want to talk about a Stanley Matthews, Tom Finney, England of earlier times being better, I mean, that's another story. But, I mean, we obviously just seen England go out of the World Cup. And I think people were saying, oh, England could win the World Cup, they could do this, they could do that. To me, there's no world-class players in that England team. There are lots of very, very good players. There's a few players who might go on to become world-class, but there's nobody in that England team now who goes into the World 11, or definitely walks into the World 11. There were four in 1966. Gordon Banks was the best goalkeeper in the world. Bobby Moore was the best central defender in the world. Bobby Charlton would walk into a World 11 at that point. And Ray Wilson was probably the best left-back in the world. If you've got four world-class players, which England had, then you've got yourself every chance. And if they're all playing well, which they were, then you're going to be very difficult to beat. Then you look at Alan Ball, Martin Peters, Jeff Hurst. I mean, they weren't far below that level at that point. And then, the rest of the team, Jack Charlton, Nobby Stiles, Roger Hunt, George Cohen, absolute tireless workers who would do all the graft, all the dirty work, not want any of the plaudits, but they would get the job done for the team. I think that is a fantastic England team. It's the perfect balance of everything for the period it was in. And I don't think it gets the credit that it probably deserves.
Stephen, what are your, I dare say, not recollections, because you certainly don't.
I just want to point out, I don't have any recollections. I was told about
none of us have recollections. I certainly don't have any recollections. Stephen, you won't have recollections, but as a football fan living in England, as we all do, it gets drummed into us every 4 years that it's X number of years since England have won the World Cup. What was the legacy of this particular success, would you say?
It's equally cursed and blessed. England did win the World Cup after all. One of, what, seven, eight teams is it now that have won the World Cup? You know, so they are amongst a very, you know, limited number of high clientele in that respect. You know, England's last World Cup was more recent than Uruguay's in that respect. And I think Uruguay, you know, double winners, obviously. But, you know, I think there's a lot more, I don't know, respect from the hipsters for a Uruguay than there ever would be for an England. You know, this is an England side that is, I don't know, sometimes damned by the faint praise that people will class the 1970 squad as being better than the 1966 squad. I don't know, there always seems to be a reason for people to not batter the 1966 squad, but to kind of, I don't know, not even belittle it, but I don't know, just take the edge off them, just to I don't know, to just not to give it the credit that it deserves. You know, as Dave said, it was a fine side that is underrated in the great scheme of things. Its achievements in winning this World Cup final are shrouded by a Russian linesman that isn't quite Russian, you know, a ball that does or doesn't cross the line, and an iconic line of commentary. You know, this is a World Cup that could have been broadcast in colour but wasn't. You know, the BBC undernarred over whether to roll out colour television for the 1966 World Cup. You know, so it remains that kind of, I don't know, monotone black and white, you know, it's surface of the moon type stuff. You know, it's kind of overtaken by events towards the tail end of the 1960s in a way, you know, in iconic terms. But yeah, you know, this is it's still the defining achievement for the England national team. You know, they still never won a major trophy, you know, before this or after this. You know, come to within a penalty shootout now of having done so, but you know, it's still always a case of what might have been rather than what was, and this is the one occasion of what was. I mean, I was born in 1974, a year that England failed to reach the World Cup final. You know, they failed to reach the next World Cup. You know, 1982 was the first time that an England side reached World Cup final in my football consciousness. It was my first World Cup, but I was utterly shocked when I turned over the Panini album on the front, the inside of the front cover with a list of previous winners, to find England's name there, because they'd been a hapless, you know, entity really in my formative years. So yeah, you know, it was a double-sided thing, I think. You know, on one side, you know, it was bewildering to see that England had won a World Cup from my 8-year-old perspective, but at the same time, you know, this is still the greatest achievement by the England national team by a country mile. But yeah, it does have that, I don't know, it's wearing it around the neck as well. You know, it's that boulder to carry up the hill. You know, it remains the benchmark until it can be usurped by a success that may never come. So yeah, equally cursed and blessed, I think.
Dave, you might not be old enough to have remembered this cup final, but you know a thing or two about Alf Ramsey. You've written books about him. How was he perceived at this point? Because he's taken an Ipswich team from the second division to league champions, which is a fairly impressive thing to do. But to then lead the country to a World Cup, having boldly predicted he would do so, and yet there was this sense of authority, not allowing the players to rest between the end of the game and extra time. You know, sports scientists would be going mental at that these days, I would have thought. There was an extreme strand of psychology I detect to his management. What was he like?
I think the interesting thing with Ramsey in England terms is in the 60s, he was the right man at the right time, the right place. And then in the 1970s, he was completely a man out of time. Completely different. I think you know, you've got to look at the players that were in that squad in 66. They were all probably, pretty much all, born during the war. Some of them had done national service. You know, Bobby Charlton did national service, for instance. They'd grown up in a different world, in a different England, and I think they were more willing to take orders necessarily, but you know, the discipline sat easy with them. It was just a natural thing for them to take. The manager says, this is what we do. Okay, this is what we do. Okay, I know Jack Charlton went over the wall at Lillie Shore to get a drink and so forth occasionally, but, you know, by and large, whatever Alf said went. And then, you know, you get to the 70s and you get the whole story is, well, what, you know, why didn't he play the Flair players, the Peter Osgoods and the Stan Bowles and the Frank Worthingtons? And he didn't understand those people, because those people were 5 or 6 years younger. They'd grown up with Elvis Presley, they'd grown up with the Beatles, and they questioned authority. They had a whole different take on, not just on football, but on the world. They had a different worldview to those players that played in 66. I don't think Alf Ramsey understood them at all, and I don't think he could move with the times as much. I mean, you know, you listen to Alf Ramsey and you hear that stupid clipped accent that he's got, and, you know, those elocution lessons that he took, because, you know, he was a Cockney. And, you know, the guys who shared a dressing room with him at Tottenham when he was a player, they had no idea who this bloke was. He was suddenly talking on the television like, you know, a BBC radio announcer. They had no idea who he was. But in the 50s, when you were going to be the manager at Ipswich, talking like a bank manager was, you know, was a positive boon, because you could sit in the boardroom with the kobolds and have sherry with them and seem as though you were their kind of people. That the Beatles and so on, and the 60s, Michael Caine and David Bailey, whatever, all those shorthands for the 1960s, that did change things completely. And by the time we got to the 70s, Alf Ramsey was just an anachronism, really, by that point, in such a short period of time.
I get the feeling that maybe that 1970 World Cup and the lines that with his almost confused state over how to use substitutes and how to address and deliver the best strategy to adapt to a Germany team that were, or West Germany team that were coming back into the match in that quarter final.
Definitely. I mean, you know, in 66 there were no substitutes. So, you know, the Jimmy Greaves thing, for instance, wouldn't have been such an issue, because Jimmy Greaves would have been on the bench, and if things hadn't been going particularly well, after 70 minutes, he comes on and scores the winner instead of Jeff Hurst or whatever. You know, it doesn't become such a big issue. As you say, by 1970, you could have two substitutes in a game. And, of course, he'd never done that at club level. You know, when he was at Ipswich, there were no substitutions. So it was a completely foreign thing to him. And as England manager, you got, in those days, what, 7, 8 games a year? To try it. And some of those games were in the European Championships, you know, in 68. So you couldn't be trying anything out there. He wouldn't try anything out against the Scots, because he hated the Scots more than he hated the West Germans, which is saying something. So, you know, the opportunity to experiment wasn't there in the way that it came later on. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, he was able to adapt, because he adapted from the way he wanted England to play initially to this wingless wonders idea. He got rid of wingers, he flooded the midfield, he had a defensive midfielder and all of that sort of stuff. So he could change, but then he got to a point where the change was just coming too quickly, I think.
Yeah, I find it fascinating just how it escalated so quickly. You know, it's a huge success and they don't build on it, but it's not for the ones trying. You know, they come to within, you know, they reach semi-final, the 1968 European Championship. Alan Mullery's sent off, there's rancor in that semi-final game, you know. So by the narrowest of margins, it might have been them that went on to face Italy in Rome in 68, you know, leading 2-0 against West Germany in 70. It's all very fine lines, fine dividing lines and forks in the road. But certainly from 70 onwards, you know, it's then a deflection into, I don't know, kind of like there's a slowing down, a mark slowing down as... Because you look at by 72, it's the football West Germany you're playing. I mean, 1970 is very much a tectonic plate in football. But there's something of the old world and something of the new. There is a defined passing of the baton. So by 1974, it's a very different footballing world. Even for Brazil, you look at the distance between 1970 and what they're doing in 1974 is all very different. So, yeah, it's the changes in football that he fails to adapt to that always fascinate me when it comes to Ramsey. And again, that takes away from the success that he achieved in 66, because it's always smoke and mirrors. There's always some kind of, I don't know, shadow puppets going on.
Dave, final word on this match from yourself. Did Ramsey stay in situ for too long?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, after 1970, as Stephen just said, I mean, you know, that game against West Germany could easily have been an England win. And then maybe they played Brazil again in the World Cup final, and who knows, maybe they win it. It is that the speed of that change from 70 to 72 That changes absolutely everything.
And it's, it's breakneck. The speed of the change is startling. You look at the football that West Germany played. They were kind of forced into it with Schoen having to play Netzer, you know, which he wouldn't have done, you know, given the choice. And you know, it's a far more pragmatic West Germany that win in 1974, but they are themselves escalating. You know, they are overtaken by the wonderful football, not just the Netherlands but Poland as well. So you know, it Yugoslavia now, how you know expansive their football was. Football changes dramatically in a very short space of time, and it does overtake Ramsey.
And I think crucially, we lose that influence of the South Americans during that period as well. Certainly for a few more years. Now, Stephen, speaking of South Americans, at least one of your choices, I believe, features a team in a South American team in a World Cup final. Tell us which particular final you're going to talk to us about.
Well, if we're going South American, we'll err towards 86 to start.
Why
with.
Not? Yeah.
Let's
have a West German defeat for a change.
There's a good book out there about the 1986 World Cup as well that people should go out and buy. But yes, you know, the 1986 World Cup final before 2018, I think there was a huge gap within, you know, the fact that there just wasn't a classic World Cup final as such. There were finals that had moments in them. There were, you know, obviously the drama surrounding Ronaldo in 98. You know, Zidane's headbutt in 2006, but when we strip those back, were the classic games? Was the, you know, the Ronaldo kitchen sink kind of destroyed 98 as a game as such? So there was intrigue, there was drama, but just on the pure footballing basis, I think between 1986 and 2018, you have pushed to find, you know, a truly flowing, epically dramatic, swaying World Cup final. You know, in 86. Isn't always a fantastic final. There's parts of that final that are quite, I don't know, just quite plodding. As Argentina seemed to be manoeuvring themselves towards a formulaic 2-0 victory, there's almost a touch of the 1979 FA Cup final about it until, you know, West Germany launched this, you know, amazing comeback, uncharacteristic comeback, because they weren't a particularly great team in 86. Certainly not by normal West German standards at that point in time. And then to have that, I don't know, totally un-Germanic approach at 2-2 to continue to go forward, to look for the winner, rather than getting to 2-2 and thinking, right, we will now go for the long game here and take this into extra time, and we will you know, make Argentina pliable, and we will pick off this victory, whether we need it on penalties or not. You know, West Germany kind of like got carried away with themselves. The comeback for 2-2, they were on the front foot and threadbare at the back when Burashaga is sent through to score the winning goal. You know, it had the dramatic late winner. It had the comeback. West Germany in green as well is always pretty spectacular. And I think, you know, how can you argue with the best player in the world winning that World Cup? As much as he is the pantomime villain to so many in England, you know, it was just right. And I think as well, the fact that that Argentinian side, they came from a very dysfunctional starting point. Under Bilardo, they had some terrible results. You know, in the 2 years leading up to it, he had to talk Maradona back into the national team. There was just so much that went on in the build-up. It wasn't conducive to Argentina winning the 1986 World Cup, yet once they got to the finals, everything just clicked into place and they got better and better. You know, Maradona, you know, is two goals, you know, the yin and yang of the quarterfinal. The goal against Italy was majestic, and the two against Belgium were just wonderful. You know, even the celebration, the way he wheels away and tries to keep his feet, is almost as stylish as the goal itself. And then to be so selfless in the final, you know, and that was the thing about Maradona at the 1986 World Cup. It wasn't just all about him, the individual. It was him as the captain, as the team player, you know, given the captaincy at the you know, at the cost of Daniel Passarella, you know, who had at loggerheads with for much of his time in the Argentinian side. You know, he would have absolutely loved that. And that's part of what gave him this impetus to go on and you know, push Argentina to victory. He had, you know, been handed the captaincy at the cost of Passarella, you know, and this was just the greatest compliment, I think, that Maradona could have possibly had prior to the World Cup. And the final itself was just, you know, a wonderful fruition to a magical tournament.
Dave, I mean, this is often described as being the World Cup dominated by one man, that being Maradona. I would suggest that's a little bit unfair on what was a fairly decent, if not a brilliant, but a fairly decent Argentina team.
No, I think you're right. I mean, you know, people do always say, oh, it's the one example of one man winning the World Cup on his own. And I think that, as you say, that's completely unfair. And the point Stephen makes, I think, is a really important one. Not only was that a decent team, but Maradona knew his place within that team. It wasn't purely about him going me all the way through. As we can think of one or two more recent superstars, perhaps in Europe, who would like it to be all about them. He was the jewel in it, but he was still a cog in the machine. You know, he did still play for the team. I mean, trying to think back to the time when the game was actually played. I mean, I think there was perhaps a little bit of disappointment that there weren't more Maradona fireworks in the World Cup final itself. Because after what he'd done in those games leading up to it, you know, you expected him to repeat Jefferson, scored a hat trick, and you know, beat 12 players and do all kinds of amazing things in the game. But he did all the things in that game that were necessary to win the World Cup, which was the key thing. And it was the example of a genius submerging himself into the collective for the good of the collective. Although there were still those fantastic individual moments, the pass for the goal, the third goal and stuff. You know, it was a team ethic. The point Stephen makes about West Germany losing the plot is really interesting because, you know, again, it's one of those cartoon things, those caricatures that come down the years that the West Germans were always ruthlessly efficient and they were a machine and they always did the right thing and the Germans will always prevail in the end. And you're right, I mean, they a little bit like that 79 Cup final when Manchester United got back into it. West Germany were the same. They got carried away with what they'd done. You know, the excitement of having got back into it and then just lost the plot. They, you know, if they had played into extra time, I think quite possibly they would have won that World Cup because the momentum was going their way at that point. But they just got too excited and lost their way. But, yeah, going back to the original point, I mean, in the same way that England are underrated for 1966, I think Argentina as a team, as a collective, are underrated for what they were in 86 just because of the genius of Maradona and all those, you know, those goals that are endlessly repeated.
I mean, it's quite interesting. I was looking at a technical report of that West Germany team, as you do, and it spoke of a very functional German side that lacked creative flair. It was almost a stereotypical Germany team without the superstars that maybe were to emerge 4 years later, maybe had been there in the past. Stephen, what were your particular memories of this World Cup? It was an unusual one. It was the second time Mexico had hosted it. It was every game seemed to be played in bright sunshine. And altitude was a huge thing. And I mentioned this in a previous podcast where I'd interviewed Jan Molby and he mentioned the utter devastation that playing at altitude causes to your recovery, but also your preparation for games and your conditioning and the way you feel, the way you recover from a run and the lag that you get from the thin air. It was an unusual climate to play football in, but it was one that clearly suited this brilliant, brilliant Argentina side led by the best player in the world.
Oh, totally. For a European side to come as close as West Germany did to win it, I suppose it's quite a shock in that respect. I mean, there were three European sides in the semi-finals. So, you know, they did kind of master it. I mean, there was a lot of intense preparation by a lot of these European nations that went. And I can't remember quite who, I can't remember which team it was now, but someone had prepared by kind of like training at a higher altitude than they were going to play. So by the time they came down to the altitude they were playing at, then it wouldn't feel quite as the shock to the system that it would do by working your way up. They were working their way down. So, you know, there was all ways and means. I mean, England likely did a lot of their preparation. Colorado, you know, it had the altitude, but it didn't have the temperatures. You know, it was a completely different thing. So while some got it right, others got it wrong. But this was, I think it would have been utterly jarring at a European, as it has been in recent years, where, you know, for such a long time, a European nation hadn't won the World Cup away from European soil, not until 2010 when Spain did it in South Africa. I think you could always at one point, I don't know, you could identify or predict, you know, the World Cup winners by virtue of geography. You know, it's so often, you know, it was a nation that was either from that part of the world or a neighbouring nation or whatever it was, and that's all gone out the window since 2010. But yeah, you know, the 86 World Cup, it just had that, I don't know, that hum. I mean, Haida Jawad, who, you know, was a friend of mine, who, you know, written for multiple publications over the years, author, prolific author, he declares the 1986 as the last romantic World Cup. And I think he's right in that respect. There's certainly, it was a World Cup where teams set out to win. You know, there were a few exceptions, but I think it became more prevalent from 1990 onwards that teams were, I don't know, setting out not to lose. You know, there was that fear of defeat was far more prominent 4 years later than it was in 1986.
Yeah, it's interesting. As soon as you said that team that didn't set out to win, I just thought Uruguay. I don't know what made me think that, probably because they were pretty much adept at S-hosery, despite having a fairly talented team, it has to be said. Stephen, just staying with you just for this moment, was there a feeling of redemption for Maradona in all of this? Because he'd had the disappointment of missing out on the 78 World Cup squad, which subsequently won. He got kicked off the field in 82, sent off against Brazil after being kicked off the field in that particular game. And of course, he'd had the disappointment of the move to Barcelona that perhaps didn't quite go as well as certainly his move to Napoli subsequently proved. There was a feeling that all of this sort of built into this crescendo that climaxed in Mexico and signed off, I suspect, what was to become the highlight of his career after all of those disappointments.
Well, going into the 86 World Cup, he's the false emperor by all intents and purposes. You know, it's not worked out, but individually he did quite well at Barcelona, but collectively they laboured. You know, he'd also spent time out with that infamous broken ankle that Goycochea, you know, afforded him, the Butcher of Bilbao, you know, so emphatically, that had that knock-on repercussion to those, you know, stunning riots on the pitch at the Copa del Rey final in 84. So, yeah, he'd gone to Napoli, but those first 2 years at Napoli, 84, 85, you know, the first half of that season, it almost looked like, you know, they were being drawn into a relegation battle. They were in the bottom four. You know, this was a ruthless Serie A era where there was just 18 teams in it, four teams are going down. You know, so there was a potential relegation battle at the turn of the year. You know, 80 by 85, 86, they're moving in the right direction, but they're still the Napoli of old. You know, they're still going to fall short, and that was the way that everyone saw them. So, you know, Maradona was this centrepiece of a dysfunctional Napoli. He'd had these two World Cups, unrequited World Cups, where, you know, Menotti had overlooked him in 78. It had all blown up in his face, basically, in 82. 86 was his point of return, not just at international level, but it was the stepping stone for what was to come. You know, without that 1986 World Cup, you know, does he have the will and desire, you know, and does he have that spring in his step to go on and win the 86-87 Serie A title? You know, he wins it again in 90. There's that UEFA Cup in 89. You know, all that success with Napoli. A lot of that is built upon his delight at winning the 86 World Cup, that validation that finally he has fulfilled the prophecy of what he was meant to be.
Dave, you've got a game between Bilardo's 86 winners and Menotti's 78 winners. Who would you go for out of the two? Which was the better success? Which was the better team? Bearing in mind what we've subsequently learnt in this podcast and in previous ones.
That'd be some game, wouldn't it? We're talking about, you know, the romantic World Cup. I mean, I have a romantic attachment to that 1978 Argentina team because I saw Mario Kempes play in England about, you know, 6 months later or whatever it was, which was seemingly impossible. This man come down from another planet and come and played at the Hawthorns in a UEFA Cup game. I mean, that was just extraordinary. It's always very difficult to look past the team that's got Maradona in it. I mean, I think as a team, probably 78 was probably better. I mean, you know, you've got...
I'd argue there's greater talent, greater overall talent within the individual components of the 78 side. But they don't have that ultimate catalyst, do they, in a Maradona. But, you know, that's a hell of a side in 78. I think it's a better collective. I think the some components are better than the ones that are there in 86. But you don't always have to have the best players to have the best team. You know, a team, you know, is a team. Players are brought in to do a specific job. You can go back to the 66 World Cup again, and you know why Jack Charlton when there were infinitely better central defenders. You know, why Nobby Styles, there were infinitely better central midfielders than him, but they were brought in to do specific jobs. And I think there was more of that in 86 than there was in 78. So they had that greater balance of talent in 78, but in 86 it was all designed to work around Maradona. Yet Maradona in turn wasn't the you know, the be all and end all, because he had that selfless side to him to go along with the individual brilliance.
I think that's true. I also don't think under any circumstances Maradona would allow his team to lose to the 1978 team. Under any circumstances.
No. Especially if Passarella's captaining the 78 team. It's fair to say those two guys didn't get on. From one South American winner to another, I'm going to take it forward 8 years to 1994. This was a special World Cup for me in many respects, because I was really lucky that the two tournaments of the early 90s fell during my exam season. Euro 92 fell during my GCSE year and 94 fell during my A-level year. So I had a whole free hit of a summer to do what I wanted and watch what I wanted. And USA 94 was brilliant. Watching it with my dad during some of the bizarre kickoff times due to the time difference. Every game seemed to be played in brilliant sunshine in these fantastic US stadia. And until the semi-finals, this was the best, in my view, of my lifetime, perhaps the best World Cup. Maybe 86 was better overall, but up until the semi-final. The semi-finals, and especially the final, which I'll be coming on to, were particularly poor games. But this... when we talk about Maradona having his climax from disappointment and that crescendo of and that build-up of frustration, anxiety, anger that exploded into this 1986 World Cup team, this 94 World Cup team signals something that hadn't happened for 24 years. The fact that Brazil, the if you like, the gods of world football, the seminal team of any World Cup, hadn't won the World Cup for 24 years. And to get to this stage and to meet what was a fairly decent, if not a great, Italy team, all the ingredients were there for another 1970 World Cup final. Of course, it wasn't to end like that. It was a fairly dull 0-0, lacking in any huge drama, lacking in any impetus, few goalmouth actions, and it took a game to go into extra time and then penalties, and lo and behold, the penalty shootout came along. Franco Baresi missed, Marcio Santos missed for Brazil. It went to 1-0 to Italy when Albertini scored. Romario equalised from the spot. Ivani made it 2-1 to Italy. A pre-Middlesbrough and fairly slim Branco made it 2-2 from the spot. And then Daniel Massaro misses, making it 2-2 still. The Brazilian captain Dunga makes it 3-2. And Roberto Baggio misses that ultimate spot kick. I felt desperately sorry for Baggio, because this felt like his World Cup. It felt like, although this Brazil team had started to build up ahead of steam and were getting better and better throughout the group and the knockout games, it felt like Baggio could claim and own this particular World Cup, having emerged in Italia 90. So for him to miss that decisive spot kick was to maybe cloud the rest of his career, sort of almost be part of his legacy, the great bridesmaid of European world football. But this was significant. This success was significant for another reason. Just a few weeks before, Brazil had been in a state of national mourning. The great Ayrton Senna had been killed at San Marino on May the 1st, 94. And it felt like there was not only this pressure from Brazil to win a first World Cup for 24 years, but to effectively give the nation a new hero. Because you have to bear in mind that by 1994, Pelé's been retired for the best part of a quarter of a century. Ayrton Senna was that equal to Pelé in many respects, that incredible sportsman who not only delivered on the track, but had an empathetic, kind, soulful, almost a spiritual outlook on life off the track. He meant so much to the Brazilian people, and they had lost him just a few weeks before. And I know that when Brazil won, they dedicated their win to Ayrton Senna. They claimed that he gave them the acceleration, in inverted commas, to win the fourth title. Ray, who was the younger brother of Socrates, was in that squad in 94, claimed that they drew inspiration from that. And it felt like such a momentous win for Brazil to not only get that particular hex off their back of not winning a World Cup for nearly 2.5 decades, but to actually give something back to a Brazil that had been just a few weeks before in a state of devastation after what happened at San Marino. Dave, I know that you share my passion, not only for football, for motor racing as well, but how important was this win for Brazil, not only for the reasons I've outlined, but for footballing reasons as well?
Yeah, I mean, unquestionably the Senna thing played a big part. I mean, you know, a country like Brazil is always, it has a need for those sorts of heroes, I think. It's got a South American thing, isn't it? You know, you see the those great legends and the murals everywhere and that sort of thing. And I think it plays a big part in the, not just the sporting culture, but the national culture of the country. And I think from that point of view, it was really important. Ayrton Senna, if anybody was indestructible, it was Ayrton Senna. And then you find out that actually nobody's indestructible in the end. So I think it was a big thing in that. In football terms, I mean, 24 years for Brazil not to win the World Cup seemed unthinkable at that point. I mean, you know, they'd won 3 out of 4 and they were the great World Cup team. And of course, by the time it comes to the next World Cup, which is in America, it'll be 24 years since the Brazilians last won the World Cup. So,
yeah, put your money on them now, possibly.
You might get your best odds about now, probably. I mean, it wasn't a Brazilian team that won, was it? You know, it wasn't that swagger of Brazil that you think back.
It was a functional team, wasn't
it? Yeah, you know, you think back to the 1970 World Cup, but you know, even 82 when they should have won it and didn't. I mean, that's the kind of football that the world falls in love with, and that's why everybody loves Brazil and all of that. And then, you know, by the time they got to 1994, it was, I'll stuff this for a game of soldiers, let's just win it, you know. And then that was kind of the approach that they had, you know, as you say, a functional team. It's just not a team that, I mean, you know, you remember the Beto celebration and all that. You know, you don't really remember a great deal else about that team, do you? You know, for Brazil, you know, Brazil should be in the forefront of your mind. It should be seared on your imagination, and that team just isn't in the same way. I mean, I have to say that I absolutely hate penalties. I cannot bear penalties. They should replay every day forever until they actually get a proper result. But you know, that's by the by. But I don't know. It somehow seemed right that Brazilian team, if it was going to win the World Cup, should win it in such a way as penalties, really.
Stephen, Dave touched upon the brilliant 82 team there that didn't win. From a Brazilian point of view, do you think it's or feel it's better to be the beautiful loser or the ugly winner?
I think Brazil want to be the beautiful winner. You know, they are spoiled. Even in Brazil, this 1994 side is relatively unloved. You know, and you know, if you are a nation that can have the luxury of being able to be dismissive about one of your own World Cup winning sides, then you know your back catalogue's pretty good, really. To be fair, and then you know, but even this 94 side, it does have a few caveats to it. Romario, you know, had his moments. Beto was a good player. You know, they linked very well together. You know, Branco was you know, at that powerful shot. I always remember him in a Genoa shirt a couple of years earlier, hitting a, you know, wonderful free kick in a UEFA Cup game against Liverpool. There was a bit of sleight of hand as well. It was a free kick that was awarded near the centre circle, yet was eventually taken about 10 yards further forward, and he blasted it in like the 88th or the 89th minute. And it was one of those kind of like pleasure and pain moments. You had to applaud it, but you kind of thinking should have been much further back. So yeah, you know, this Brazilian side had its talent, but that frustration for the final. You know, you look at kind of like a game like the quarter final against the Netherlands, that went one way and then the other. Were they two up and then back to two all and then win 3-2? You know, they had the two face offs against Sweden. You know, they were restricted to a 1-0 against the USA. So that, you know, there was pragmatism at play, but bubbling under the surface, there was talent, and I think that was why people are, I don't know, find it hard to love this side. But at the same time, 4 years earlier in Italy, they took a very Europeanized approach, and it, you know, on the back of, you know, having these glorious failures of 82 and 80, because you've got to bracket 86 with that as well for Telly Santana, is that, you know, the 82 side was so good that 86 kind of gets overlooked, and they were still a fine side. Yes, you know, Zico was only on the periphery of the side because of injuries, and, you know, he was called up eventually, you know, under pressure, really, to put him in the squad. But, you know, Socrates was still, you know, magnificent, and they were getting stronger and stronger through the 86 World Cup. You know, they put three past Northern Ireland, they put four past Poland on a day when Poland played quite well as well. You know, dominated the game against Italy across the 90 minutes, only for France to come on strong in extra time and win the penalty shootout. So, you know, they'd had these beautiful sides that had lost. They'd gone for a Europeanized approach in 1990. It hadn't worked. They'd gone out in the last 16, you know, played the percentages there in Italy. 94 was a mix of the two. It was kind of like a few little elements of style, but still that pragmatic approach. But as Dave said, 24 years, it was too much. You know, if they hadn't succeeded in 94, they were fast approaching three decades by the time they could have changed that again. And with a World Cup in Europe, that was always going to be difficult. So, you know, this did have a kind of, let's just get it won and maybe we'll win it again a little bit further down the line with a little bit more style and substance. And the fact that you've got a 17-year-old Ronaldo watching on from the sidelines, who isn't given, you know, even a cursory few minutes in a game that they're running away with in the group stages, you know, it just has that little kind of, I don't know, it's like drinking a diet, you know, or an alcohol-free beer.
Dave, just a word about the Italy team here, because, I mean, they were fortunate to get out of the group in the first place. Lost to Ireland in an infamous game where every Ireland player looked like they'd been painted red, struggling to cope with the demands of the, I think it was the, was it the Miami Sunshine that day, wherever the game was played. It was played in extreme heat at midday. They beat Norway 1-0, drew with Mexico. They only got through by virtue of having one more point than Russia, who just missed out. They were the fourth best third place finishing team. So just about made the cut. Beat Nigeria 2-1 in the second round, having beaten then Spain 2-1 in the quarterfinals before beating the conquerors of Germany, Bulgaria, in a fairly dull semi-final. This wasn't a great Italy team, but it probably, by the end of that 120 minutes, would have felt fairly satisfied with what had gone on, and under the, of course, the guidance of the brilliant Sacchi.
Well, you know, I'm going to be hypocritical, naturally. Having slagged off Brazil for being pragmatic, I'm going to be full of praise for the magnificently Italian way in which they came through the competition by doing just exactly enough and no more to get to the final in perfectly Italian fashion. I mean, you know, it's what you were saying before. That should, in the same way that 1982 should have been Brazil's World Cup and all of that, that should have been Roberto Baggio's World Cup, because he was the player of that competition. I mean, he did drag Italy through the various rounds. He was the fulcrum of it all. I mean, not quite as showy as Maradona in 1986, but, you know, along the same sort of lines in terms of his importance to his team and the way that he carried them through. For them to lose the final and then for him to obviously have taken the crucial penalty, that was cruelness on a cosmic scale, I think. you look back on that tournament and it was, there's lots of moments that you can remember from it. But there wasn't, you know, that same sense of there being a great team in here that you get, you know, you got in 82, you get in, you know, so many World Cups. It was all in bright sunlight, and yet at the same time, it was quite a monochrome World Cup. I think it was a point at which so much of it was levelling out. Yeah, and we've had more and more of that in world football ever since. I think the standard of coaching and organisation, and you know, the fact that we were familiar with everything by then, we were watching more and more football. We were getting, you know, cable television, satellite television. We were starting to watch games abroad and all that sort of stuff. Everything was a bit more familiar. I don't know if it's necessarily the fault of the competition or just the fact that we were becoming better, more literate in football or seeing more football generally. But it didn't have quite that same sort of special feel to it.
That's a really good point. And I think, Stephen, this felt a bit like the last World Cup before digitalisation of our world. You know, although maybe we weren't all hooked up to the internet in 1998, we already knew what it was about. We already knew that it was going to transform the way we consumed sport, the way we consumed our news, the way we consumed our lives. And it feels like 1994 was perhaps the last World Cup of a more innocent age, a pre-Champions League hogging period in football, certainly from a club point of view. It felt like the last World Cup maybe where international teams held the upper hand over a growing dominance of club football.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said in that. What Dave said about kind of like us all becoming much more conversant in or much more learned in the footballing world, there were less things to find out at World Cups. So, you know, you could you know, by then Channel 4 were a couple of years into showing football Italia, but then Sky had shown it for a few years earlier to that. You know, I used to watch it on a Monday night on a hazy S4C broadcast, Scagorio, which was wonderful, unmissable Monday night programming, even though you couldn't quite see it properly. So, you know, we were becoming more conversant in it. You know, there were less surprises. You know, I think that whole concept of it felt like once every 4 years, or in European terms, every 2 years, because you'd have a European Championship thrown in. We'd all find someone that we'd take and clutch to our heart from each World Cup, but we kind of knew who these players were by the time we were getting into this World Cup, and you know that would only go further. And I think what it did after this, that sense of occasion became diluted in that respect. You know, I can remember a World Cup final feeling absolutely massive. It just felt like the whole world was stopping to watch, no matter who was in it. The same can be said for the FA Cup final for a long time, you know, and around about now is where it starts to change. You know, that sense of occasion, this is huge. You look at the players and think this is the biggest day of their lives. You know, maybe the birth of children or a marriage or whatever it is. You know, this is the next big thing, you know, and you could see it in them. And I think that has become lost more and more over the years. You know, we'll watch a 2022 World Cup final on Sunday and we'll see the players walk off a coach with the headphones on, head down, not interacting with anyone. And it could look exactly like the first day of the Premier League season. It could easily pass for Brighton versus Watford or whatever it is. You know, it doesn't look particularly special. It doesn't look particularly unique. You know, I think that the whole dilution of it kind of starts now, I think. You know, the 1994 World Cup final felt huge in the build-up to it because of all the connotations for 1970. But then Italy kind of, I don't know, I think their approach is based in not repeating what happened in 1970 and not having that, you know, being swept aside so categorically. So, yeah, you know, I think this is a tipping point, but the fact that it's such a disappointing final for the second successive time, because the 1990 World Cup final was an absolute dog as well. You know, I think that, you know, again, there's fine lines. You know, Romario misses an early chance in the first 10 minutes or so, and if he scores that, then it's a completely different game because Italy have to come out and be that bit more expansive. You know, Brazil will be looking to pick off a second goal, and that's where the fork in the road came with the 1994 World Cup final, is that that ball doesn't go into the back of the net, and it becomes a completely different kettle of fish, because it's that fear of failure. And this is where, you know, it kicks in beyond to a very prone. And we talked earlier about how football alters between 1966 and 1974 so emphatically, and it does between 1986 and 1994.
And of course, do I not like mentioning this? But of course, it was the World Cup that famously or infamously, the last time England didn't qualify, Dave. Does that have an impact on how we see a Mundial these days?
I think it's a tragedy that Carlton Palmer never graced the World Cup.
Oh, and Andy Sinton as well. I'll see you at Carlton Palmer and raise you on Andy Sinton.
Oh, I'm looking at Keith Curl right now, thinking you've both lost this particular one.
Oh, Keith Curl got a European Championship though.
Oh, he did. He did indeed. He did indeed. And didn't that go well? Moving on to our second round of finals. Dave, you gave us 1966 earlier. What have you got first this time?
Well, I was initially going to go for 1970, which is, of course, the absolute pinnacle of all human life on Earth. And we might as well have just knocked it on the head as a planet at that point.
Can I just say, go on YouTube, but it's much better than listening to us three talk about it.
But I think Gary has given us chapter and verse on that Brazilian team over the last couple of episodes. So I thought we'd try something in the 21st century, shockingly enough. And the 2006 World Cup, only coincidentally because Italy won, it was the team that I've supported every tournament. I don't know that you would call it a classic World Cup final, because again, it ended up on penalties and not particularly exciting to it. But it had its moments. And I mean, obviously, the moment is Zidane's headbutt, which we will come on to in a few minutes. But I mean, I think one of the great things for me in that World Cup, it features two of my absolute favourite players of all time, Pirlo and Zidane. I mean, they are just wonderful, wonderful players. I think Pirlo won the man of the match in the World Cup final. Zidane was named the player of the tournament. And they are just the kind of footballers that I like to watch. I mean, I'm going off at a tangent here, but that film about Zidane, we ought to do a series about football films, actually. Put that one on the back burner. but that film about Zidane, I could watch that over and over again, because nothing seems to happen for 90 minutes, but it's all those little details and nuances as the camera follows him around in that, you know, relatively uneventful game, which then suddenly explodes into just a few moments. And that, I mean, that is Zidane, really. I mean, you know, he's this gloriously elegant footballer who always plays the right pass and always, you know, always sees every movement on the pitch, and he sees all the pictures and all those cliches. And also, he's a complete nutcase at the same time, you know. I mean, he got sent off 14 times in his career. I mean, that's like Willie Johnston. I mean, you don't see Zidane as a man who gets sent off. I mean, in the group stages, he missed the last game against Togo because he got, you know, he was suspended after two games of the group stages of the World Cup, you know. So there's the World Cup final in lots of ways is everything that there is about Zidane. I mean, he scores the Panenka penalty. But right, 7 minutes into a World Cup final and you take a Panenka penalty. I mean, that takes something. You know, he's playing passes all over the place. And then, you know, he headbutts Materazzi and, you know, effectively doesn't lose the World Cup final. But, I mean, given that they lost out on penalties and he probably would have scored his penalty, I mean, it was a significant moment. I mean, yeah, France were ahead after about 7 minutes. It was a pretty dubious penalty. Malouda went down on a breath of wind and Zidane took the penalty, and then about a dozen minutes later, Pirlo corner, Materazzi bangs in a header. And then, I think on the half hour, Italy repeat exactly the same corner, Pirlo puts it into the... And it's Luca Toni this time, and his header bangs against the crossbar and goes over. And that's basically all that happens for about the next hour and a half, really. Buffon makes one great save from a Zidane header, and then there's that explosion, you know, where he has his altercation with Materazzi and ends up headbutting headbutting him to the floor. And Materazzi, in the aftermath, I'd forgotten about this, but I checked it earlier today, and apparently the Times, the Sun and the Daily Star used lip readers to find out what Materazzi had said to him. And they published that Materazzi had called Zidane the son of a terrorist whore. Materazzi then sued and won damages off the Sun. And as far as that, you know, that should make him the player of the century, really, just for doing that, frankly.
I automatically feel a lot more positive about Marco Materazzi on the back of that than I did 3 seconds ago.
Apparently, he said the far less inflammatory thing. I prefer when Zidane offered to give him his shirt. He said, "I prefer the whore that is your sister." So why is Zidane would then go and headbutt him? Who knows? But yeah, and then there's that fantastic shot as he gets the red card and he walks past. And it's his last game. He's retiring at the end of the World Cup, Zidane. And his final moment on the football field, he gets sent off and he walks past the World Cup, sitting on the side of the... I mean, that's is Shakespearean, isn't it? And then you get the, you know... After that, the penalty shootout is a bit of an anticlimax, but the right side won, so frankly, who cares? And again, I think that Italian side, again, is underrated in the way that, you know, you look at some of the players that got Buffon, who was probably the best goalkeeper in the world, perhaps at that point. You got Cannavaro, you got Gattuso, who I always loved as a footballer. I know everybody hated him, but he was just a fantastic, you know, the kind of player that you want on your team and you would hate in everybody else's. And as I said, Pirlo, who I think is, if push came to shove, I'd probably have as one of my favourite player of the last 20 years. I think that was a really, really strong Italian team, doing Italian things all the way through that competition. And probably their best performance was in the semi-final against Germany, which I thought was a terrific game. And if I'd done the semi-finals, I would have picked that as one of my favourite semi-finals. But I think in the end, and this doesn't always happen in the World Cup, but in the end, I think we got the right winners of that competition in whatever strange circuitous route that we got there in the finish.
Mind you, Stephen, that wasn't a bad French team either. You know, you look at the lineup: Thuram, Gallas, Abidal, Vieira, Makélélé, Ribéry, Zidane, Henri. I mean, we're not talking about mugs here. We're talking about footballers who were to, and maybe goes back to an earlier point we made that, you know, '94, if it was the last of the kind of World Cups where we saw players every 2 to 4 years. This was a World Cup where we were seeing players that we're familiar with, that we were seeing every week on the Premier League stage, in the Champions League. I mean, it was a great side, but beaten by an equally great side.
Yeah, I'd say the French side was the stronger of the two going into this. Yeah. And there was also previous from 6 years earlier when Italy had you know, glory, you know, snatched away from them in the Euro 2000 final. I always remember how the players on the Italian bench were all linked, you know, arms around shoulders, ready to race onto the pitch to celebrate winning the Euro 2000 final when Wiltord forced in the equaliser that took it into the golden goal extra time that was eventually decided by Trezeguet. So, you know, and also with Italy as well, it's that backdrop of Calciopoli as well that was lingering. You know, and there was a bizarrity around that Italy. And I think you know, Dave's right. It was the right team that won. I won money on the back of them winning it. I think I backed them at something like 8-1, 9-1, maybe even 10-1 that year. I just had that sense that they were going to win it. I think, again, like you said earlier, you could predict the World Cup winner by geography, and I did. I opted for Italy, you know, winning in Germany because, you know, there's only a thin sliver of maybe Switzerland or Austria that splits the two in terms of geography. Germany had won in Italy, and that was part of my reasoning. And, you know, backs against the walls and feeling like the, you know, everything's closing in on them. Touch of 82 about that with Rossi coming back after Toto Nero. So there was, you know, this element of us against the world that just felt compelling about Italy. But France, that French side, you know, was probably pound for pound superior to the Italy side. You know, it was, you know, wonderful, but also dysfunctional because it wasn't always the easiest of you know squads. It wasn't the most harmonious of landscapes under Domenech. You know, there was a lot of you know flare ups. They it's an era when France suddenly became the new Netherlands in that respect. You know, which version of them are you going to get? Are you going to get the self-destruct version, or are you going to get the magnificent, beautiful version of them? And that was never quite what France were about. You know, and they did. That's what they became under Domenech. So yeah, you know, I think pound for pound, that French side had the better side. I mean, we talk about Materazzi, we talk about Gattuso, and you know, a lot of respect for Gattuso. You know, watched him on the losing side for Milan in the 2005 Champions League final, and was always quite pleased that he had the temerity to touch the trophy on the way out for that final, which a lot of people will point to as being the turning point. Not the fact that we came back from 3-0 at half time to overturn the whole thing, but you know, that's where it was won and lost. But the fact that, you know, that's a jarring thing is that they had two players in that World Cup starting lineup that had played for Everton and Glasgow Rangers. That seems so un-Italian. And I'm not you know, mocking Everton and Glasgow Rangers here, but it always seems quite, it's like, you know, Argentina now reaching the World Cup final with a Brighton and Hove Albion player in the repertoire. It seems so weird, you know, from the perspective of growing up and these players. You know, Italian players always played in Serie A because it was the centre of the footballing universe, and it stopped being this football, the centre of the footballing universe roughly when Zidane made the move to Real Madrid. You know, that's where the sea change kind of comes. Yeah, there are some jarring oddities about that Italy side compared to the French side, but you know, the right team won. You know, they looked like World Cup winners, you know, well before that final. And although there was just a sense of destiny about it. But yeah, that, going back to the original question, that French side was incredible.
And Dave, you know, for me, a World Cup is about the football. And when it's not about the football, it's about the story. So if there isn't a great game in prospect, what you're looking for is that hook of a story. What's the big story of the game? And it seems that, a bit like Maradona in 94, a great player who leaves a World Cup in disgrace, we've got Zidane, a wonderfully gifted footballer, the kind of guy you'd pay money to go and watch train, wonderfully talented, won the World Cup in 98, and leaves the world stage with that famous photo, as you alluded to earlier, of him marching past the World Cup trophy in disgrace, having headbutted Materazzi. Tell us the significance of this particular moment in this game.
As I said, Zidane had always got that kind of thing in him. You know, you don't get sent off 14 times and be a choir boy, obviously. And I suppose, you know, when we used to talk about people like George Best in the same way, that element of him must have lit the fire to the genius as much as it did to the, and yeah, Maradona. You know, another case in point. The fact that those two elements, that genius and that self-destructibility, live side by side and rub up against one another, that must have, you know, that's the combustion that drives the magical moments, I think. And you know, people say, oh, if only he could stop being like that, he'd be perfect. If he could stop being like that, then he wouldn't be Zidane. He wouldn't be Maradona. He wouldn't be George Best. He wouldn't be whoever it is. But it was just, you know, it came from a moment of nothing, you know, because they were just walking back up the pitch. There'd been a tug of the shirt and words were exchanged, and all of a sudden he's headbutting Materazzi in the chest and he's falling over and, you know, turning it into an opera. And Zidane gets sent off. You have to think, looking at it, you know, in the sort of the wider lens. I mean, as I said, he got suspended in the group stages, he gets sent off in the final. And that final was his last game. You know, he announced his retirement. He was leaving the stage altogether. And you can only assume that just the emotion of it all, a World Cup final, it's heading towards penalties. He's going to have to take a penalty. He's going to be the first one to take a penalty probably. It all just built up and built up and built up and just exploded in that one moment. I mean, in terms of the game, it's significant because surely to God he would have scored. And that moves, you know, France one further penalty down the line. In the end, it's Trezeguet who misses the second penalty and Italy score all of theirs. But Grosso, when he takes that final penalty, he knows that even if he misses, France has still got to score to level things up. I mean, that's a slightly more comfortable position than if you get into the point where it's 4-4 and you've got to score. So, I mean, does it change the destiny of that World Cup? Possibly it does, you know, if Zidane stays on the pitch. Possibly France go on and win the penalty shootout. But as I say, you know, it's Shakespearean. There's something weirdly perfect in the fact that he starts that World Cup with a Panenka penalty, that it's the crossbar, comes down, just goes over the line and then comes back out again, and Buffon tries to pretend that it didn't go over the line. And then he ends it by headbutting somebody. And those are the two poles of Zidane's whole career, really. And it's all there in that one final game.
Well, from one Italian success to another, Stephen, tell us about your second final.
Oh, 1982. It's a work of art. You know, it's the first World Cup final that I properly remember. You know, I always refer to 1978 as World Cup Eve. You know, you're shown so much of it. I mean, that era before we all got wall-to-wall coverage of different leagues and even getting to see like the Copa America and stuff like that. You know, we go back to the late 1980s and ITV showing late night Copa America and stuff like that. But, you know, 82, the footage in the build-up to 82 is basically revolves around what happened in 78, maybe a little bit about the 1980 European Championship and that type of thing. So, you know, you never quite know if you do you really remember the 78 World Cup as it happened, or is it just that you're shown so much of it in the build-up to 82? But 82, you know, I had the Panini album, the wall chart, I had the whole lot. You know, watched the games, went out and recreated them with my mate over the field or in the streets. You know, absolutely fell in love with that Brazilian side, but not just that Brazilian side. You know, just got so, I don't know, enwrapped by the whole 24 teams, you know, of that tournament. You know, I have a soft spot for every. I think all 24 teams of that World Cup, I have some kind of soft spot for probably. It was the 82 final. You know, that Italy side that's just so complex at the 1982 World Cup. You know, lucky to get through the group stages. Three games, three draws. They only go through because two of those draws are 1-1 rather than, you know, one of them is 1-1. They only narrowly get past Cameroon. There's a lot of pressure on Paolo Rossi because he's been brought back to be able to play in this tournament. His ban has finished a year early. There's a little bit of sleight of hand as such in the fact that he's there. Even the Italian fans are, you know, kind of against her. Not so much the fact that he's come back, but the fact that, you know, he's not played for 2 years, he's not fit, he's lost his touch. But then he explodes into this, you know, blizzard of goals. Italy are wonderful against Argentina, not just Brazil, in that second round group stage. Then they beat Poland, having played Poland again in the semi-final. And the final, you know, the world's kind of been against them because they've knocked out Brazil in that iconic game at the Sarria, you know, which was just the most hypnotic thing to watch unfold in real time. It never leaves me, that game. And yeah, you know, I think the whole world, you know, were against Italy for a few days. But then Seville, West Germany, France, you know, France lead 3-1 in extra time. West Germany come back for 3-3. There's the Schumacher and Battiston moment. The, you know, Stielike has the temerity to miss an early penalty to suggest that France were going to win the penalty shootout, but they don't. You know, there's the typical Bond villain nature of West Germany mean that where Italy go in about 6 days, 7 days from being, you know, the bad guys to the good guys at the 1982 World Cup. You know, the performance in the 82 final is actually very, very, very understated, you know, under-celebrated. You know, it's a fine, fine performance. And this is a game in which they've lost one of the key players as well. You know, Giancarlo Antagnoli, who played so, you know, so well throughout the tournament, picked up an injury in the semi-final, would miss the final. So, you know, Giuseppe, there's a juggling around of the team, and a very young but old-looking Giuseppe Bergami comes into the side as a teenager. And it just has a little bit of everything there. And that goal from Tardelli, the thing with Tardelli's goal is that the celebration became such a, I don't know, a, an icon, as well as kind of like a weight around the tournament's neck, but it became so, repeated an image that it kind of lost its mojo somewhat. But when you kind of stripped it back and looked at the goal that provoked the celebration, it's an incredible goal. And especially if you find it online, but it has to be with John Motson's commentary. It's, you know, it's Scherer. It's all of that. It's Pete John Motson. It's the burnabout. It looks like, you know, the height of sophistication. And the bad guys, the Bond villain, has had his final comeuppance because he's come Italy to kind of, you know, win the day. And to not just win the day, but to win in style as well.
Thank you for that, Stephen. Dave, what are your memories of this particular game? So beautifully articulated by Stephen there.
It's absolutely true. I mean, you know, I remember when Italy beat Brazil. I was mute, I think, for about 12 hours after the game. I couldn't think of anything to say. I was just stunned that it could possibly have happened, that Brazil had lost. Because, I mean, that was just, I don't know. I mean, I was six when it was the 1970 World Cup. And as I say, I do still think it was the pinnacle of human life. But, you know, I was 18, I suppose, in 82. And you can take it in better. And that was just the greatest team that you could ever hope to watch, that Brazilian side. And the fact that they'd been beat, I mean, I couldn't take it in. I was just struck dumb for the rest of the day. It was just horrendous. And then, as you say, you know, they played, particularly as you got to the final, and West Germany were just West Germany, you know, like they always were West Germany. You just knew that they were going to steamroller their way to it in the end and win. And obviously, all of the stuff that had gone on in the semi-final had made them even more West Germany than ever. And everybody was just, oh, Christ, they can't win. We can't let them. And everybody was suddenly on Italy's side. I mean, you're dead right. It was, they've got to win. They've got to win. We can't let West Germany win this. This would be wrong. This would be a crime. And then to not just to win it, but to win it in style, and for an Italian team to win it in style at a time when, you know, people still, everything about Italy was defensive football, and it was, you know, 1-0 and shut up the shop and all of that. And that was still the common stereotype about Italian football. To play the way that they played and to score those goals, and then the Tardelli celebration. I mean, all these idiots who have their synchronised dance moves now, they should just be showing that celebration. That's what you do when you score a goal. None of this dancing rubbish. You do that.
Yeah, and Stephen, Dave's absolutely right there. But I want to just bring us back to the Italian team and Beerzot, who, after a fairly poor, uninspiring group of opening group games, of course, as it was then, we had two lots of groups, keeps faith with the misfiring and the somewhat previously disgraced Paolo Rossi. I mean, Beerzot's put his reputation on the line to not only recall Rossi into the Italian fold following the betting scandal of a couple of years earlier, but to actually keep him in when there was huge pressure for him to replace him, when Paolo Rossi hasn't yet scored. It adds to the whole dynamic and the narrative of that particular success. We see Italy go from this team that struggles to get out the group, draws with Cameroon, draws with Poland, and slowly grows into this particular World Cup.
This is completely the opposite of what had happened 4 years earlier, again under Beerzot. You know, Italy have been all-encompassing in the group stages, won all three games, beat the hosts, Argentina, sent them off to Rosario, you know, kept the, you know, themselves in Buenos Aires, and then progressively got weaker through the second round group stages to the eventual exit in the, you know, what was the de facto semi-final against the Netherlands. And it was almost like Bezo took that as, well, let's reverse that. Let's play the percentages earlier and build ourselves up. And it was a complete reversal. But yeah, they just got progressively better. You know, the semi-final is quite formulaic, but, you know, they were incredible themselves against, you know, an incredible side in beating Brazil. I think within that, you know, it, it, I think, it, you know, yes, it broke the hearts of kind of like football watchers, World Cup watchers in 82, you know, far and wide outside of Italy. But at the same time, I think those same people whose heart were broken respected what they did because they'd gone toe-to-toe with this great Brazilian side. And when the dust settled, I think this is where, you know, that respect came through by the time the final came around. And it wasn't just a case of it's West Germany, Italy have to win. You know, there was that element. But I think a lot of people have kind of like been won over by them as well, by their own, you know, improvements, their own style, the fact that Rossi was scoring these goals, you know, for fun. And suddenly, you know, Italy were attractive. Everything that they hadn't been in the initial group stages. And they'd had their own kind of hurdles to get over as well. I'd mentioned the loss of Antonioli for the final, but then Graziani, you know, limped out of the game within 7 minutes to replace by Altobelli. It's also like the touch of class at the end in throwing on Franco Corzio the 89th minute to say, you know, he was out there in a World Cup final. It just had so much going for it. And this is 2 years on from Italy having fumbled their own European Championship as well. You know, the chance to succeed on home soil, something that would be mirrored 10 years later at the World Cup. And, you know, there was, again, that backs against the wall element. And that's often the best that you get from Italy is when they feel like it's them against the rest of the world. Yet, you know, this is a self-perpetuating, self-propelled situation because, you know, the world itself kind of like seems to love Italy more than they're willing to let on, or more than I think Italy are willing to accept. My love of the Italian national side springs from this World Cup. You know, it's everything about them. You know, it's the style, the substance, you know, the wonderful sounding names of the players. The Bruno Conti missed a penalty in the 1982 World Cup. And there's another hurdle to get over. But, you know, such a magnificent... They all play for these magnificent teams in magnificent stadiums, in magnificent cities. It's style. It just drips from them. When they are on the crest of a wave, there is nothing quite like, you know, the majesty of the Italian national team from a European perspective. They are the icons, the style icons of Europe in that respect. They pull it off in a way that no, not even Germany can do. Not even the Spain of 2008 to 2012 can match. You know, this Italy just have that swagger, you know, and they limped into the start of it. They swagger by the end of it.
Thank you for that, Stephen. And we're going to be moving on finally to a different kind of game for Germany, or West Germany, as they were to be known for the final time, the 1990 World Cup final. The final of first time a finalist hadn't scored. It's the first time two previous finalists had met again. Also the first time, I think, that an entire nation had been bored to tears by a final. It was a forgettable game. Just a little bit about these two teams. West Germany were probably the team of the tournament, and that's not saying a lot. I don't think I think we romanticise Italia 90 because of the journey that England took, because of the stories of Cameroon, to some degree Ireland. But it wasn't a great particular World Cup. And yet the Argentina team that stumbled in its opening game to Cameroon just about got out of the group, was hammered by Brazil in the second round, but got through thanks to a moment of genius from Maradona, setting up Caniggia, got through on penalties against Yugoslavia, got through against Italy on penalties. This was by no means a classic Argentina team, but the two strands to Argentina sides, from my knowledge and from my history of watching them, that is they play quick, incisive football and that they play with aggression. This wasn't a particularly talented or easy on the Argentina team, but they did that second part well. They were aggressive, they were destructive, and they strangled and squeezed the life out of games. And in this particular game, it was hard going. They completely held a West German side at bay who had been taken to extra time against England, won on penalties. we had the first sending off in Monzon, being sent off for giving a straight red for a tackle that was maybe a little bit unfair. De Zotti then got two yellow cards and was sent off. And it just seemed like the worst possible, the antithesis of what a World Cup final should be: dull, unambitious, physical, all about the anger, the hate, the rivalry. It felt like one game too far for both teams. And it took a Bremer penalty late on to clinch the game. And it was just, in my view, one of the worst finals ever. And yet, there's a certain element of it that of admiration for this Argentinian team who completely S-housed their way through an entire tournament. There's a narrative, and I mentioned this in the semi-final podcast, that England missed out on a World Cup win because they lost on penalties to West Germany. But I honestly think that a gazaless England would have struggled against this Argentina team. They weren't there to play football. They were there to stop the opposition from playing football. And they almost did it with West Germany. I think they would have done it against England. Gentlemen, starting with Stephen, what are your thoughts on this particular final and this particular, well, what I've just said, really, about not only a fairly good, if maybe limited, West Germany team and an Argentina team that were extremely limited in many respects?
This Argentina team is, you know, they were, it was like 86, they were so often billed as being a one-man band, massively unfairly in that respect. In 1990, they were, you know, the ego had properly landed. The team would come out of the coach, except Maradona, who would then exit the coach himself, like, you know, surrounded by the paparazzi, and, you know, the world, and not just football, had escalated around Maradona in the 4 years between these two tournaments. And this Argentina side was the worst to reach a World Cup final in my lifetime. Massively anti-football. You know, 7 games, they scored just 5 goals. You know, 2 games that went to extra time. I think I worked it out for a... They scored a goal in regulation time once every 138 minutes. You know, this truly was a woeful, you know, spectacle. I mean, as a team, you know, they did the job and they got to the final. Sergei Goycalo drives me nuts. You know, wonderful penalty, you know, ability to save penalties, yet a truly atrocious goalkeeper and regulation player. I can remember a moment in the quarterfinal where he almost scored an own goal, a kind of one of those crosses, and you don't know whether it's a shot or a cross, that drifts across the 6-yard box, and it was going wide, yet he kind of tips it towards his own goal and onto the post. And it was kind of like, you know, it was just the strangest scenario that this World Cup final. And I think everything as well that speaks of this final in particular, you know, the tournament is, you know, has its aesthetic beauties and its sleight of hand and all that, but the final itself being so atrocious. What is quite telling is that no one seems to be too, I don't know, incensed by the fact that West Germany win this final. Nobody seems to be too incensed by the fact that the penalty is somewhat contentious. You know, I think people were just glad that it was over in the end. And it didn't matter how it was over, it was just that it was over. You know, it was never a penalty. You know, in a month of whatever day of the week you wish to choose, that should never have been a penalty. And the fact that Argentina side came to within 5 minutes of pushing the World Cup final into extra time, you know, it is a work of negative art. You know, you've got to put your hands up and say that. But I so wish it could have been something else. You know, if that had been West Germany, Italy, perhaps, had it been England, Argentina, as you say, you know, no Gascoigne, it might have been more difficult than they'd have expected. But I think even down to the fact that, you know, it wasn't Argentina in stripes and Germany in green, I resented that as well. You know, they were in opposite colours. You know, it was just a truly dreadful World Cup final, which, you know, based on kind of like what I had experienced in 82, which was this magnificent final between Italy and West Germany, you know, the 83 six final. Again, West Germany were there. I at this point, had never known anything other than West Germany reaching World Cup finals. I had no recollection of a World Cup final without West Germany being in it. And suddenly, you know, very soon, there would be no West Germany by the end of the year. You know, it was incredible. And that West German side as well, you know, Gary Thacker, you know, absolutely, you know, cringes any time I say it, is that they were the best team at the 1990 World Cup.
Yeah.
You know, they win the World Cup from 12 yards in the end. Penalty shootout in the semi-final. You know, apart from a mad deflection off Paul Parker, it is all from 12 yards from the quarterfinals onwards. One goal wins it in the quarterfinal. It's Czechoslovakia. It's a penalty. The penalty shootout in the semi-final and then Bremer's penalty in the final. But prior to that, they've been magnificent. They put four past the hipsters' favourite, Yugoslavia, in the first game. They put five past the UAE. They were on the brink of beating Colombia when a late equaliser comes. And they rise to the bait against the Netherlands in the last 16 quite fantastically, you know, in a sea of spit and rancour. You know, they prevail by playing the better football. But then the percentage play the way to glory from the last eight onwards. So, you know, even within that, you know, the best team do win, but in an unsatisfactory manner. And no one, absolutely no one, was particularly incensed by the fact that West Germany won it by a penalty 5 minutes to the end that shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have been given.
Indeed, it was Sensini's challenge on Fuller. But strangely enough, Bremer took the penalty. Matthias was ordinarily should have been down to take it, but wasn't happy with his footwear. He'd changed his boots.
There was another thing as well. It was the quarterfinal. It'd have much more charm if Matthias, when he scores that winning penalty, had done it with a Panenka. Just to kind of like turn the tables.
Absolutely.
On 76.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, Dave, this was a fairly charmless final. I think from a perspective of living in England at the time, there was a feeling that England's World Cup finished 3 days earlier. You know, we had the third place playoff, which nobody puts a great deal of stock in, certainly after losing a semi-final. And this game was it just felt like a desperate, desperate evening of football.
Before we come on to that, you've chosen this and you've chosen the 1994 World Cup. Are you okay? I mean, is there something you'd like to share with us? You're a psychiatrist or something?
I just like going a different way. I think that it's so easy to choose a 3-1 or a 4-1 or whatever. But
well, you haven't done that.
Well, I haven't. I have a fascination about this Argentina team not being as bad as it was, but at the same token, being the worst team to get into a final. I think they give hope to every single clogger, every single anti-football team that there is in a World Cup, that you can S-house your way to a World Cup final. And they did that, you know. I didn't, until Stephen pointed it out, didn't realise quite how much West Germany regressed during this World Cup, actually, in terms of the threat they offered towards goal. But I mean, this final itself, it was just I remember it was a Sunday, it was a beautiful day, beautiful summer in England, and it was just the worst possible way to bookend what had been such a interesting, fascinating World Cup, starting with that ridiculous game between Cameroon and Argentina 1 month earlier.
I suppose this World Cup was the experiment of what would happen if you put Tony Pulis in charge of a team with Diego Maradona? and this was kind of it, I think. From an English perspective, I suppose, you know, you're right. I mean, it was after the Lord Mayor's show and all that kind of thing. I mean, there was the disappointment of the semi-final and what if, and, you know. I mean, we started with 1966. Perhaps this was the best chance England had had, have had, since 1966 to win a World Cup, probably.
And on that note, Dave, how would England, and I think it's fair to ask this question, although we're talking about finals, how would England have fared in this final without Paul Gascoigne? And of course, let's not forget Argentina without Justi and Caniggia, both of whom are suspended from semi-final sendings off and yellow cards. So they're under strength as well. How would England have gone in this one?
That's one of the fascinating things about World Cups. It's all subplots from 4 years earlier or from history, isn't it? I mean, England would have had revenge from 86 and the hand of God and all that. I mean, you know, we'd have had 3 days of non-stop pontificating on that leading up into the World Cup final. Obviously, Argentina would still have been motivated by beating England for the Falklands and all that sort of stuff. So there'd have been all those extraneous things going on. I think Argentina would have made it even more difficult for England to win than they made it for West Germany. I think there would have been even more motivation to beat England in a World Cup final. But that said, I mean, they were such a terrible team, genuinely dreadful team when you're talking about that level of the world game. I think England, the one thing England could do would score some goals. Even without Gascoigne, they'd still got the potential of, obviously, you've got Gary Lineker up front, you'd got, you know, David Platt in that team who could create stuff and score goals. And I think an England team that had beaten West Germany, having not beaten West Germany since, you know, 1966, would have been on such a roll of momentum that I think that England team probably would have won that World Cup final, even against Tony Pulis.
Stephen, what are your memories of this World Cup? Because I've got this real bee in my bonnet that we hold Italia 90 up as some kind of festival of football. Actually, my memories of it are of good stories, dramatic moments rather than good football. Let's not forget that we then changed the back pass rule because there have been so few goals in this particular World Cup. What are your memories of it? Am I being harsh or is that a fair summary of what, you know, those 30-odd days in Italy during that summer?
I recently described it as being a World Cup I was desperate to love, and I think I did at the time, and it was like only the progression of time that made me look at it and think, you know, that wasn't as good as what had been before. But by then I'm 16, you know, I've just left school, you know, I didn't go into college, I went straight into work, and I actually kind of like walked away from a job simply to watch the World Cup final, the finals, to have the whole month off to watch the finals. You know, and it had its moments, and it was kind of like looking at someone's holiday photos, basically. You know, this was a good night, or that was funny when that happened. And it was all like, you know, what it lacked was kind of like the classic game. You know, where was it France 3, West Germany 3? Where was it, you know, where was it Italy 3, Brazil 2? It didn't quite work that way. You know, there was a lot of pragmatism at this. Pragmatism came into fashion. I don't know, a brand of pragmatism that wasn't there 2 years early in West Germany at the European Championships. You know, there was a very, you know, I described the 1988 European Championships as being, I don't know, the one for the purists. You know, 84 is for the romantics, 88 is for the purists. Some wonderful football, you know, very diverging tactics and formations. But 1990, say that fear of failure, you know, teams setting out with a primary mission not to lose rather than to go out and win.
And this also felt like the first time teams started to exploit the rule around three teams potentially qualifying for most of the groups. If you finished third, you still had a chance of qualifying. Teams had latched onto this and were starting to adjust tactically to it, which perhaps also lent itself to that particular narrative.
Yeah, I think so. You know, you look at the England group where, you know, there was going into the final games, there was the potential for them all to finish level on points with the same goal difference, and they would have to draw a lot. You know, in the end, Ireland and the Netherlands did for, you know, which team would finish second and third. But there was a possibility that all four teams would be drawing lots. You know, so there was a lot more percentage playing. You know, this is an Argentinian side that finished third in their own group and made it all the way through to the final, which is anything other than unsatisfactory, you know, and which is something that's been repeated in the most recent of European championships. You know, since it's gone to 24 teams, they have the same format. Portugal in 2016 won it from finishing third in their group. Belgium reached the semi-finals in 1986, the World Cup, from finishing third in their group. It just doesn't feel comfortable. It doesn't feel, you know, it feels unsettling You know, if you finish third in a group of four teams, you should be out. You know, 36 games is a lot of football to be played for jettisoning eight teams from a tournament. It doesn't sit right. So, yeah, you know, there was, I think, a lot. I think you look at the South American teams as well, and, yeah, you know, Brazil had the fingers burnt with the Santana's beautiful teams falling short. You know, came to Italy with a more pragmatic Europeanized approach. Argentina, you know, like you said, shit hours the way to the final. You know, the most, you know, Uruguay by and large, which were, you know, not quite as cynical as 86, but not far away. You know, the most authentic of South American sides in Italy in 1990 was Colombia, basically, and they, you know, self-destructed in that most magnificent of manners. But this was the 1990 World Cup, it was all about these little kitchen sink dramas and you know, little flashpoints, really. You know, be it Scalacci, be it Roger Miller. It had its stories, it had its subplots, but the main body of the story was kind of lacking. It was about, you know, if it was a movie, you're looking at it being Ocean's 12 or Ocean's 13 rather than Ocean's 11.
I was going to say Police Academy 6.
Yeah, there's a bit of that in it as well.
Well, in line what with Dave asked me earlier, I'm off now to go and watch Steaua Bucharest versus Barcelona from the 1986 European Cup final. And to quote the great Kenneth Wolstenholm, there are people on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is now. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.